Does technology make us all richer? It certainly can, but it's also possible for it to benefit only a small segment of the population, the most powerful segment, and accelerate inequality. This is the argument made in the new book, Power and Progress, Our Thousand-Year Struggle Over Technology and Prosperity, by Duran Acemoglu and Simon Johnson. Duran is a New York Times bestselling author, award-winning economist, and institute professor of economics at MIT. Simon is a best-selling author and a professor of entrepreneurship at the Sloan School at MIT, where he's also head of the Global Economics and Management Group. His work has been published in the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, the Atlantic, and the Financial Times. Here's Simon to share five of their big ideas.
Hi, my name's Simon Johnson, and I'd like to tell you about my new book with Duran Acemoglu, which is called Power and Progress, Our Thousand-Year Struggle Over Technology and Prosperity. This is a book we've been working on for a long time. It's a book with an enormous amount of history in it, some economics, I think pretty easy to understand economics, and plenty of politics also. And it's coming out at a really exciting and interesting time for technology and I would say for prosperity, which is the advent of a technology known fairly generally as generative AI, or more popularly perhaps as ChatGPT and its competitors. So let me tell you the five things that I've learned from writing this book and from talking to people and from engaging in debates around these issues. These are our five big ideas, our five key insights from the book. The first insight is that improving technology does not necessarily lead to more prosperity. Now, this might seem like a strange idea. We've become very used to people saying you need to have technological change, you need to have innovation, and that will necessarily increase wages, improve living standards, and expand opportunities. But unfortunately, when you look at the historical record, and that's why we have 1,000 years of pretty organized history in the book, that history says it's more complicated. And in fact, there are many instances before the modern era when changes in technology and improvements in technology did not lead to shared prosperity. So one example would be medieval times, when the spread of water mills and also the adoption of windmills led to higher productivity in agriculture. But that did not lead to higher prosperity because most of the labor was not free. People were forced to work on the land of the people who had power. Now, those people who had power did really well out of the higher productivity. They got enough money to build those fantastic medieval cathedrals that you see when you go to Western Europe. But that was not shared with the peasants. The peasants' wages did not go up. Their living standards were abysmal. There was disease everywhere. And in fact, the whole episode ended rather terribly with the Black Death. So there are many other episodes. We go through them in the book, including what happened with the cotton gin in the American South, what happened in the first 100 years of industrialization in England, including in the north of England, where I'm from. And the story is the same, that increases in productivity, sometimes even dramatic increase in productivity, do not necessarily produce shared prosperity. They may well produce fortunes for a few people, but not broad-based shared prosperity. The second insight from the book is a little bit in tension with the first one, but I think we can resolve that tension. And that is that improving technology is essential to economic development. If you go back over 1,000 years, or we go back in the book as far as you can, actually, with any kind of recorded history, which is about 10,000 years. The key point, though, and the key reconciliation between these insights is about shared prosperity. So what does it take to share the gains from higher productivity? It's a political process, obviously. Who has political power? It's also a social process. Who has prestige? Who can shape the vision of what you should do with technology? And from that flows many choices about what we're going to build. Are we going to educate people? Who is going to participate in the higher productivity activities? Are they going to be paid more money to go along with that higher productivity? Now, interestingly, perhaps for some of you at least, it's those of you who've taken economics courses, this is a pretty new idea for economics. Economics and economists are generally more comfortable with the idea that there are big processes, not so much about individuals that drive history and economic history. And we're saying, hold on a moment, if you look back at the choices that we've made and we look back at the visions that shaped those societies and shaped what kind of technology was developed, you see it's very much about leadership. There's a huge role for charisma. A few individuals, one way or the other, can tip the balance. That's a really important point for what's going to come later in the book. So we want technology to improve. This is not an anti-technology or anti-productivity gain book, but it is a book that says you only get shared prosperity when you work at it and when that comes out of the political and social process. The third insight from the book is about what you exactly need for prosperity to be shared. Now, one thing that's very clear in the historical record is that you want there to be new tasks being created at the same time as machines arrive and automate away previous jobs. A good example we talk about quite a lot in the book is Henry Ford and the innovations that he brought to assembly line production, particularly when he brought electricity into his factory, which he did on a bigger and more effective scale than anyone had done before. Now, that automation obviously replaced some jobs. Some parts of car assembly that had been done by hand were now done by machines. That's what automation means. But at the same time, Henry Ford and everybody who was working with him, both upstream, meaning providing the components went into cars, and downstream, meaning how cars were used and what people did with those services, being able to drive around. All of those activities generated new tasks, created new jobs. People were doing things that had not previously been imagined. And the scale of the transformation from about 30,000 or so cars being manufactured in the US in 1900 to 2 to 3 million cars being manufactured in the 1920s. That was absolutely transformative. It increased the demand for labor. When you increase the demand for labor, you're going to tend to pull up wages, the price of labor. That's absolutely a key point. Related to that, and really running alongside it, is the development of countervailing power. So Henry Ford was a very powerful individual. He had a lot of sway over his workers' lives. He wanted even more sway, by the way. He was a fairly paternalistic chap. However, at the same time, and partly because the demand for labor was strong, trade unions developed. Those trade unions wanted rules, they wanted protections for workers, they wanted higher wages. That's a countervailing power against the power of Henry Ford and the industrial barons, if you like. That juxtaposition, that counterbalance, was really very helpful for overall growth and shared prosperity. And linked to that is broader political representation. Very clear part of what happened in Britain in the late 19th century, the rise of trade unions also meant increasing representation for labor. But across the industrial world that was industrializing, late 19th century, early 20th century, there was an expansion of the franchise. Workers got more political voice, and that helped them get more rights and helped them get treated better, including in factories with rising productivity. And that also meant higher wages and improved living standards. Alongside this, the governments of those countries, the United States, the UK, other parts of Western Europe, developed the ability to some extent to regulate business. There was a rise of the antitrust movement and antitrust thinking, so monopolies were no longer tolerated. There were constraints on how you could treat customers. For example, the railways were not allowed to engage in price gouging. And there was also a tax on corporate profits, for the first time a meaningful tax, that took some of the gains that industrialists were receiving from expanded productivity, their share, if you like, and plugged that back into public education, into building health systems, into key elements of shared prosperity. The fourth key insight from the book is that while the early and mid 20th century did develop a counterbalance to industrialists' power, but without choking off productivity gains, so innovation occurs, technology changes, and wages rise, wages for everyone pretty much rose in that period. Our fourth point is that after 1980, so starting about 40 years ago, there was quite a big switch in ideology and thinking around how business ran. Sometimes this is described as shareholder primacy, the idea that shareholders come first. I mean, honestly, that idea has been around for a long time. What happened after 1980 was a change in the emphasis so that, for reasons we go into in the book, an influential set of people persuaded a lot of other people in the policy space and around businesses that shareholder primacy meant you had to squeeze the workers as hard as you could. That was not the prevailing philosophy, by the way, of U.S. business in the 1920s. They had a much more conciliatory and cooperative approach, including to how much they paid workers and how they treated workers. after 1980, there's a really big squeeze on. And you can see this in relative wages. So the wages of people with a lot of education continue to rise after 1980. But the wages of people with less education or people who didn't finish high school actually decline in relative terms. And for some of them, they actually decline in absolute terms. So some people in that category, not very well educated, are actually earning less in real terms, adjusted for inflation, than they were in 1980. More broadly, those same constraints, the countervailing power, the political representation, the regulatory abilities of the government, these all became weaker in, we call, and many people call, the digital age, because that's when digital computers really took off. And while productivity continued, it was not particularly stellar productivity growth. And it definitely was not shared in the way that it had been shared in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s in the United States and elsewhere. So if you think about social achievement on a broad base, you could say that we, and the people who came before us, snatched defeat from the jaws of victory. We had overcome the major problems of industrialization. We had brought everybody, not absolutely everyone, but most people together with rising wages and improving living standards. And after 1980, things fell apart. The fifth insight from the book concerns what happens now and going forward, because of course we're in the middle of another wave of innovation, which is associated with generative AI. ChatGPT, which was launched in November of 2022, is a leading version of this. That's one that's coming from an alliance led by Microsoft. There's other versions, for example, Google, owned by Alphabet, has its own rival. And perhaps there are going to be just two powerful companies in this space. Perhaps there will be a few more. It doesn't seem likely that there's going to be hundreds. So the book tries to dig into how generative AI is going to play out, who's going to win and who's going to gain. And when I'm asked what is the elevator pitch for the book, I often say it's the thousand-year backstory for ChatGPT. So in part, we talk about where ChatGPT came from, what the thinking is, who shaped that technology, who have been influential individuals, because all of those things really, really matter. And we also talk about ways in which that technology is already being used. How does it help different kinds of people? Now, again, this is not a gloomy book. This is not a book that's negative about technology. It's a book about the choices and the key choices that are still to be made around generative AI, including, in our view, this very sharp distinction we should make between the prevailing philosophy among the leaders of the computer science and the tech industry, which is focused on machine intelligence, making machines able to do things that humans can do or replace us in those tasks. That, we think, is not a good idea. It's really something that gets a huge amount of emphasis in the tech community. But why is that the right approach? We would much rather prefer, and we draw on an alternative tradition in computer science to emphasize the need for machine usefulness, which is designing computers and developing technology that actually helps people, helps them become more productive, including helping workers who didn't go to college or didn't finish high school, helping them become more productive. If we can find ways to use technology to raise the productivity of those workers, and this is a big if that higher productivity can be converted into higher wages, either through the pressure of the workers or the overall regulatory environment, or maybe it's through social pressure and social expectations. That is the key to shared prosperity. If the machines displace people, if automation rules, if we don't create enough new tasks, then I'm afraid the technology will have much less positive effects with regard to shared prosperity. Some people may still make fortunes, as we've seen in previous episodes. The technology may still have impact on overall average productivity levels. So perhaps you get higher output or higher GDP, key measure that economists look at. But are you going to have participation in that prosperity for everyone? Or do you need to have at least a college degree or an advanced degree or even a PhD in order to participate, in order to really gain as generative AI rolls out? These are the questions, and this is the right moment to have this discussion. And we will be presenting this book to all kinds of audiences with all kinds of perspectives and having a very wide variety of debates as we bring these five insights to anyone who will listen, and as we push everyone to consider the best way to build a more pro-human, pro-humanist path for technological development. Thanks very much for listening. I really hope you enjoy the book.
Thank you, Simon. That was five big ideas from Power and Progress, Our Thousand-Year Struggle Over Technology and Prosperity by Doron Acemoglu and Simon Johnson. I'm Michael Kovnat. Have a great day.